wrong, sir. Wrong.
Our high school guidance counselor used to ask us what you would do if you had $1 million. Didn't have to work. And then invariably, whatever you'd say, that was supposed to be your career. So if you wanted to fix old cars, then you're supposed to be an auto mechanic.
So what did you say?
I never had an answer. I guess that's why I'm working at Inatech.
No, you're working at Inatech because that question is bull to begin with. If everyone listened to her, there'd be no janitors because no one would clean up. If they had $1 million.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Well, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do.
If I had $1 million. If I had $1 million.
Well, I'm up at Stacks and Jacks. I'm somehow Matt Byrne on the board, Jim Lawler in studio. I'm going to give a little sports report here this morning as well as other stuff because, of course, gee, imagine that, Jimmy. Stuff happened over the weekend. I'm shocked, as they say. S&P futures are down 25. NASDAQ futures down 100. So we had the announcement over the weekend was we're doubling steel tariffs on Europe, so Europe's all pissed off. Everybody's all pissed off at everybody. I guess that's that's today's mantra, wouldn't you say? Definitely. Yeah,
definitely.
I actually read some interesting stuff this weekend on tariffs, which I will. I didn't. Audrey gets this thing from Nancy, and same gentleman I talked to. It's from the Heritage Institute, and they write some really good stuff. I think it's probably a conservative think tank, but they some pretty bright guys. I might try and get one of those guys on the show.
Hmm.
One of the guys with a huge history of essentially. A money supply and things during the various wars and so forth, and was very critical. As a matter of fact, I've quoted the guy a bunch of times on stuff there in the Confederacy and everything. And this one was on tariffs that I was reading, and it was pretty interesting. Before that, Jimmy, I didn't have a chance to send this to you, but there was a thing in Core Digest of all things about some this evidently when NASA was training for going to the moon. They would practice out in the desert someplace, and they were practicing one day, and they ran into these guys that were Navajos, and the older dude he couldn't speak any English, so they said, well, you know, when we land on the moon, we're going to put down a whole bunch of like a plaque or piece of paper that has greetings from all different groups in on the Earth. Would you guys like to put a phrase in or something? So the kids translate to the old guy, and the old guy gives him a phrase. The dude gives it to him, but he won't translate it. So they go up there, they land on the moon, they put the thing down there. And then when they come back, like the next group of Nassau people a couple of years later bumps into the same people. And one of the guys there heard about it, and he asked the guy, hey, would you mind translating that for me? Guess what it said? Guess what the guy said?
What?
White men steal land. So, how appropriate, eh? just a little anecdote. The actual was beware of white men, they come to steal your land. anyway, so the story is that Trump first he puts the steel tariffs on EU 50%, so they're all pissed off. And then is Hastert now become the new Hassett, the new guy comes out and is he gives the speeches for front running or something? Now is that his new job? Came out and said that Trump and Z are going to meet after Trump came out 2 days before and said, oh by the way, we're pissed off at China because they're not taking care of their agreements, and so now 2 days later he comes out and says they're going to meet, but he doesn't know when. So I don't know if that's positive or negative, but these things are all you gotta. And learn how to interpret here if you're going to do this kind of trading. But anyway, when John comes out, we'll talk about the tariff stuff. And either you guys got stuck Saturday night, went to this wedding where I didn't know anybody kind of thing, but it's another story. But I was watching the Channel 9 news, and for some reason, Jimmy, they had They had a big special, I don't know, some kind of an anniversary of the Japanese internment camps in World War II. And how lousy they were, and how many citizens were in there, and blah, 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 and how tough it was on everybody, which I can only imagine, or I actually can't even imagine. And how at some point, this had worked its way through the courts, and the Supreme Court finally issued a ruling that says you can't intern American citizens. What are you doing? Well, of course, they didn't pay any attention to that. Now, this is, and then the war ended, and they let everybody out. So the court system was virtually useless the entire way through. So you have to, you know, I think we need to be careful now as these guys get a little more aggressive, kind of playing fast and loose with the Constitution and everything else. I don't know if the court's any kind of, there's no enforcement from the court. They just keep doing what they want. It's pretty scary.
Well, that's the issue. The court can pass the laws. It's the enforcement of the laws are up to the government, and since the government decides which one they want to pay attention to and which one they do not want to pay attention to. So, I mean, the court could say, you can't do this, and...
Well, first they were 3 years late.
Right.
By the time it worked its way through, and then it's delayed, and it was over anyway.
That is true. It was not a very particular nice time for U.S. history that we put them up in the internment camps up in, what, Washington and Oregon.
Yeah.
And we didn't do it because we didn't understand or figuring these people are Asian and Japanese and that they could turn against us. So we have to isolate them.
Well, the lady who was on there, and I don't know how long ago her interview was, because she must have been one of her parents were there, I would guess, but I don't think it was her, even though she looked pretty old, said it had nothing to do with that. It had to do with all their stuff disappeared. I mean, you were able to bring your, like, clothes with it. It was enough to live. But all your worldly possessions, the stuff you own, what happened to your car, what happened to everything else, people stole all that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they were let out, they were given 25 hours and a train ticket, like out of Oregon and Washington. And a lot of them came to the Midwest. Apartments had big signs. I was like the Irish. No Irish need apply. No Japanese. They wouldn't rent them apartments, wouldn't do anything. These guys are citizens. It's pretty bizarre. I mean, anyway. Hey, so we do a little bit of a sports report like we used to do on Monday, and we haven't done it in a while. Although it seems like there's so much news on weekends, we end up talking about it. But mentioned to a few people yesterday, the one piece of sports news coming out of the news is that evidently none of the Bears stuff made it through Springfield, eh?
Not yet.
Well, they're done. The session's over, so I guess they're...
They got to wait until it reconvenes.
Yeah, I guess it's a veto session or whatever, but I'll probably wait until September. Anyway, one thing I will say is If you don't, whether you like baseball or don't, or haven't watched it in a while, and maybe you're upset with Chicago teams, this kid playing center field for the Cubs is worth watching. He could be the best ball player I've seen in 20 years.
PCA, yeah. Pete Crow Armstrong, absolutely, Chief, absolutely. He has great range, he has good arm. He's getting better at the plate, still kind of swings at everything, but as reflected as his average shows. Some days he's up near 300, some days he's down about 275, but he is exciting to watch and fast.
He made a catch on a Saturday. Was really incredible. Yes. You don't really, unless you, I think, you know, I haven't been to a ball game in a while, but I will say this, that if you are a fan of baseball and you watch it on TV, if you can, as my brother says, and Dan was a really good softball player and still playing, you need to go once in a great while just to see how hard the average play is to make and how you could never make it. And when you talk about, you know, covering 100 yards or wherever they cover for one of these fly balls, a sinking line drive, you sit there and go, oh, my God. You know, it's really something. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, these people are such singular athletes just about at all levels of competition that once in a while, you just have to, you know, the normal two hopper you see on TV, well, that's routine. You watch it in person, you go, boy, that's not all that routine, is it, Jimmy?
No, it isn't. And I mean, it takes a good amount of skill, A, to kind of figure out where the ball is going, and then B, get there. That one that you were talking about on Saturday, that was a sliding catch.
Yep.
And it was a tremendous amount, the jump he had, and to make sure your body is in control and get to there and make that catch.
There are people that have innate ability to get the jump on the ball. There are people, not very many, they're exceptionally fast. You sort of rarely see it in the same person. You know, he combines almost the speed of a Willie Davis with the jump of a Jim Landis. I mean, I've never seen anything like that.
Very true.
Anyway, so we got golf, we got soccer, we got all kinds of stuff. We got to go through the standings. I'll dig up the standings. What's going on in soccer for a minute? Because that's not usually my game.
Well, Paris Saint-Germain won the European Championship. That is the, for people who don't know, that is when the pro teams actually compete against each other, all in the first division. It is kind of a round robin. You have to get in, so you have to be playing well enough to get into the tournament. And Paris Saint-Germain basically crushed Inter Milan 5-0.
None of the British guys were in there?
Nope, none of the British teams were in. This is Paris Saint-Germain, or PSG's, first time winning it. And they played an incredible game. And then, obviously, in golf, Scotty Scheffler is the man. I've never seen anybody more consistent in my life. It doesn't seem like he feels any pressure. He lets everyone else fall apart.
Yeah, he just keeps knocking them down the middle and watch all the people fall apart around him.
Correct.
What is the interplay? I mean, if you know, it's kind of complicated. What is the interplay between these pro leagues and the qualifying for the next World Cup is already happening?
World Cup is different. World Cup has to do with the country.
I know, but all these guys play for all these other teams, right?
They do. The World Cup is your country. So in the World Cup, you have World Cup play. So these guys take time off to generally play for their country for qualifying rounds.
Is the World Cup when the leagues aren't playing so they can all do this?
No, the leagues are playing. The difference is it depends on... there are like the COFI Cup, which is the South American Cup. The winner of that gets an in, right? Obviously, if you are the winner of the last World Cup, you're automatically in. So there are things. Now, obviously, in some qualifiers, the really depth teams, Brazil, Argentina, they don't have to put their whole star team on there to get to the point of qualifying.
So the next World Cup is when? It's not 4 years, it's three, right?
It's 4 years.
I thought the last one was delayed or shortened up.
The last year was shortened up because of COVID. That is correct.
So it's not till what? When is it? It seems like it was just last year, the year before.
It should be 4 years. So if it was 2022, it should be next year or 2028. That's how it goes. It's always 4 years. It's always about 2 years behind the Olympics.
All right. Okay, but I heard something. My nephew was telling me they're already qualifying.
Oh, yeah. The qualifications go on throughout the year, throughout that time period. You have friendly matches and you have qualifying matches. And you basically, like the U.S., will have to play...
Well, they're already in because they're hosting, right?
That is correct. Us and, I believe, Canada.
The next one is going to be in 2026.
Yes, next year.
So it's going to be co-hosted by Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. I mean, they all get in?
That's a good question. Mexico will probably get in anyway because they'll win the North American Cup. U.S. is going to be qualified, and I don't know if Canada is... But you basically have a bunch of friendly matches, and some of them are qualifying matches.
There's going to be 48 teams instead of 32.
Correct.
So United States beat a rival bid by Morocco. How the hell can Morocco be big enough to host one of these things? But they were
those countries have, big football, soccer following. They have the stadiums, but I think it just goes down to who has bigger sponsorship. Now, how you're going to do it between the three countries here, that, you know, you're going to have some qualifying matches in Canada, some in Mexico, and some in the United States, and then when you get into what they call the sudden death round or the knockout round, I don't know where that's going to be played. Do you play it?
The total number of games played will increase from 64 to 104. That's a lot.
Yes.
And the number of games played by teams reaching the final four will increase from 7 to 8.
There you go.
The tournament will last 39 days, an increase of 30 from 32 days in 2018. Each team will stay. Teams will be split into 12 groups of four teams, with the top two of each group.
Correct.
And the eight best third base teams progressing to a new round of 32.
Right, and that would be the knockout round.
Yeah, and then if you lose one there, you're toast, all right?
That is correct.
All right, well, let's do the quick standings in baseball, then we'll get back to the markets. I've got the Yankees, even though they finally won one game of the Dodgers last night. I watched that. The Yankees are in first place in the East by five games over the Blue Jays, so they're pretty much off to the races. The the Cubs are going to play Detroit. Detroit are the best record in baseball, 39-21.
Yes.
And then the Mariners are tied with the Astros in the West. The interesting part, I don't know if it's that interesting if you're from Baltimore, but the Orioles won like 100 games last year, didn't they?
Yeah, I think close to 90.
And this year they're 22-36. They let a free agent guy left. I watched the Sox play out there. It was like friends and family in the stands. There's nobody there. You'd think they'd have a massive season ticket load after two huge years, but evidently they don't. Last year they were like 36-22, and now this year they're 22-36. I mean, they got nothing but injuries in the in the pitching staff. Evidently, people think that when all those guys come back healthy, they still can make a run at it. Even though they're 14 games behind, is a long way to make a run at it from, I think. I think they got problems. But it's not one of the good news stories in baseball. National League, the Mets are one game ahead of the Phillies in the East. It's pretty tight. Mets 37-22, the Phillies 36-23. The Cubs are on top of the Central now by four games over the Cardinals, 37-22. So the same record as the Mets. And in the West, the Dodgers are 36-23, two games ahead of the Pirates. That's a little close over there because the Pirates and the Giants pretty much have the same record. So there.
And Colorado still has not had double-digit wins.
It's incredible. They're 9-50. They only had 9 wins when they came to Chicago 2 weeks ago. They haven't won since, huh?
That is correct. They are at an 8-game losing streak.
They fired the manager, and I don't think that helped.
I agree. I don't think...
Well, Baltimore fired the manager, too. Did he make all the guys hurt, or what?
I have no idea. I think nowadays that, you got to find... If you're not doing well, you fire the manager. That's the first thing, and then you go from there. Then the question is, at some point, do you have a fire sale? Do you have anybody that people want?
Well, as a person who still has tickets, meaning you... The idea of dumping your players in the middle of the year, that always frosted me, because that happened to me like 3 times when I had Cup tickets. And every time, it drove the nail in me closer. I can't wait to get rid of these tickets. I mean, the low blow is I couldn't give them away. So I called down their board of trade floor back when we had people on the trading floor. I said, I got 4 tickets for the Cup game this afternoon. Does anybody want them? And he goes, yeah, we want them. I said, really? Somebody wants to go? He goes, no, we got a big pile of them in the middle of the pit. We'll just make the pile bigger. That was like my last, that was it. After that year, we dumped them.
Well, I think the season ticket holders of the Sox feel the same way. Having gone to a game and maybe go this Sunday, you basically can sit anywhere. I don't think, honestly, Chief, that when I went a week and a half, almost 2 weeks ago, there were 11,000 people there.
And that includes people that went and didn't show.
That would be correct.
Well, if you had to guess, how many people you think were actually there?
I'm guessing they didn't even show the attendance, so I'm guessing between 11 and 12,000, and you're talking a stadium that holds 25, so it was half full.
Well, that's that's not bad. I've seen it nights where it looks like there's 3,000 people there and they announce 11.
Right.
That's a, you know.
And this was a Saturday, Sunday day game. It wasn't a night game.
You were a day game.
Yes.
And anyway, the, well, we, this week we're going to have a, shall we say we got some stuff to talk about because we have, I don't know where we're going with this tariffs and stuff. I don't see, this whole tariff thing that I was reading had to do with, I didn't realize the Civil War almost started earlier over tariffs. Because when Jefferson became head of the Treasury, the U.S. was kind of broke after the Revolutionary War, and he instituted tariffs. And the idea was to make businesses competitive here. And most all of the businesses you were talking about had to do with some kind of cloth weaving or whatever. We'll talk more about this when John Flanagan comes on. But
yes, textiles.
And it was all textiles. But then the South became more of a competitor with Europe, and there was a huge fight between the North wanting to essentially create the garment district in New York by tariffs, and the South essentially participating on the other side. It was almost a, I'll have more of the details, but it was almost a cause for the Civil War to be fought. It was that big of a deal. It was long before they were bitching about slavery, 20 years. And so tariffs have always been somewhat of a controversial thing. But as the guy who wrote the article said, I think people have to understand that they're always being paid for by people here. And when you were talking about tariffs for cloth and so forth, I mean, everybody here had to pay more for clothes, except for the people in New York who controlled, had big say with the Congress. So, I mean, it's always been who benefits by it. I mean, over the long term, you could say it put those businesses to put them in business, for lack of a better term, because the whole idea was not cloth. Everybody can make cloth. It was making the thread that was the big deal, right? And the thread was the thing. So the cotton, South was exporting cotton. Mm-hmm. Less than they wanted was tariffs coming back this way from other places. And he was light about Trump. I mean, he was, somewhat, he didn't really comment all that much. He basically talked about that the original general agreement of tariffs on trade way back when was probably, he said, the single biggest benefit to manufacturing and to income rise than anything the world has ever done with the World Trade Association. He did mention that one of the flies in the ointment was China. When they were let in, it might not have been the best idea because everybody did, all they did was cheat before and all they did was cheat after. So they pretty much, for some ways you could say they kind of blew the thing up a little bit. And again, I'll do more about this when Jan comes on, but they kind of blew the thing up a little bit, and he said there still were a couple of iterations where tariffs on cars coming from here to Europe were bigger than the cars from here, in the same way with Japan. You can say that, but also, I don't know that the cars from here, anybody ever wanted them over there. I mean, we've got to go to a break here, but Jimmy, it's a very multifaceted argument, but the guy basically said is that the better you can get the free trade without people cheating, the better it is for everybody. And he basically went through the same economic analysis that I've done on the show a few times, that just because wages are cheaper in somewhere else, doesn't necessarily mean they're cheating. It just means they have more people, they have more labor, and they have less stuff to go with it, power and whatever else, investments. So labor is their asset. And as long as you're not, it actually is a way to push those countries to do better economically, and as long as you're not creating slave labor like China. That's cheating, obviously. But in Korea, that's how you end up raising the economics of the country, is you have people working. They're making a lot more than they would be otherwise, and over time, they'll end up making more and more as the place gets more and more economically advanced, you would think. That's the theory, and in most places, it actually has worked. Now, China does it a political thing. He basically said the same thing that almost like Trump has been saying from the get-go, as to why Trump has expanded it to all these other places, I don't know. But anyway, let's go to break. SP Futures now down 18. As they futures on 95, they were down like 40 something last night. So we've come back about halfway. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
How much confidence do you have that your investments will make you wealthy? Do you truly know the odds? Welcome to Luckbox, the control freak's guide to life, money, and probability. Luckbox shows you how to factor in the likelihood of success before you commit to an investment or any other life decision. Your brain is smarter than your gut, and that's why you owe it to yourself to read Luckbox. We've made it easy because Luckbox is free for 1 year at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Each new issue dives deep into the current investing climate, separates the signal from the noise with timely, actionable trading ideas, and equips you with savvy investing tactics you don't already know, all while exploring how to live your best life through music, spirits, food, sports, travel, fitness, and a whole lot more. Luckbox is the essential magazine for proactive investors who are hell-bent on controlling their financial futures. It's for overachievers and alpha types who don't buy into Wall Street's investment gurus. It's for mavericks who believe in life, luxury, and the pursuit of happiness. It's for you. Smart investors don't bet on possibilities, they play the probabilities. Luckbox is $7.99 on newsstands, but you can subscribe for 10 free digital issues at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks. Don't rely on luck. Get Luckbox at luckboxmagazine.com/jocks.
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Hello, this is Tom Howe, the Chief. I think most of you know that I am also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients, and you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello, North Bank Stocks and Jacks. Half time out. Matt Byrne on the board. SP futures down 18. NASDAQ futures down 95. We were down more. We've come back. We have the Dow futures down 107. I don't really see. We got Chevron Texaco up $1.57. Reason for that is oil's up a bunch here this morning for the first time in a while. Boeing's up 318. Those guys are back up over 200. So I won't say they're doing something good, but they're doing better than they were. Let's put it that way. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 71.3%. Euro auto stocks fall 2% as Trump's 50% steel tariffs inflate EU trade tensions. There you go. FTSE up 2, call that flat, kick around on 36.5%. So for some reason, FTSE does not bounce with these other guys every day like they used to. They're a little bit independent. Nikkei down almost 500, 494, 1.3%. Hang Seng down 131.6%. Shanghai down 15.5%. So pretty much across the board, Asia-Pacific markets lower after Trump says he plans to double steel tariffs to 50%. Let's talk about Mr. Flanagan. How the hell do you crow about this fantastic deal with Nippon taking over U.S. Steel, and the next day you double the steel tariffs? The lack of consistency here is beyond my comprehension. Treasury up 1 basis point, 4.43%. So the 10 years been pretty the upside the last few days. Bund up 2 basis points, 2.53. We have oil making a big move today, 4%, up 251 at 63.30. OPEC has kept output unchanged. I think people thought they were going to increase it. They have not. OPEC Plus. OPEC Plus is OPEC Plus Russia, I believe. Brent up 231. That's 3.6%. Natural gas up 23 cents, 368. RBOB up 5 cents. Good thing I filled up the truck yesterday, Jimmy. What do you think of that? Gold up $62, $62.80. It's almost 2%, 33.51. Silver up 40 cents, 33.43. Copper up 19 cents. That's 4%, 487. That's a huge move. Foreign exchange, the dollar's down a little bit. The euro's up to 114, which is kind of a recent high. British pound's at 135.36. So, again, that's kind of a recent high. We have crypto down 792 at 104.317. So, that's still pretty high. Now, what do you got for us, Trevick Weather Sports?
Yeah, good morning. Currently 6:38 a.m. on June 2nd, 2025. Let's look at traffic real quick. Inbound on the Kennedy from O'Hare to Jane Byrne Interchange at 45 minutes. Outbound at 75. Inbound on the Dan Ryan from 95th to JB at 15 minutes. Outbound at 11. Over to weather in Chicago, 53 degrees currently in Midway and 51 at O'Hare. High of around 84 degrees today with cloudy skies. Tonight, breezy with a chance of showers and a low of 67 tonight. Down in Phoenix, Arizona, 69 degrees right now. Today, clouds yielding to sun with some spots of showers and a high of 93 degrees. Over to sports, MLB yesterday, White Sox lost to Orioles 3-2. Meanwhile, Cubs beat Reds 7-3. Sox play Tigers in Chicago tonight at 6:40. Cubs back on Tuesday night with Nationals. Meanwhile, Diamondbacks won against Nationals 3-1. We also see the NBA Finals, Game 1 this Thursday, June 5th. Pacers are set to go against Thunder at 7:30 p.m. So I got, Chief, over to you.
So, Jimmy, what is the story in all these sports now where they, of course, everything has to be planned for TV. If the Knicks would have lost on Thursday night, it would have been a solid week in the middle of June when you don't, well, not at the beginning of June, where we don't start the finals. What, Major League Baseball does the same thing now. If both Nationals, the National League Championship Series, if they both sweep, they wait like a week and a half before starting the World Series in friggin' November. I mean, what is the story with this?
The best I can tell you, Chief, it has to do with money. They want to make sure that everybody has their chance to get their advertising in and get those dollars. I don't think that the NBA is super excited on these two teams. These are not big markets. But I would say that they're probably going to be a pretty good matchup. I think OKC is a little bit taller and a little bit longer than Indianapolis because they have Holmgren and their other center, which, you know, Indianapolis I don't think has a true center, do they?
I don't think they do either. Well, it's going to be interesting, but the thing of it is, I think there's a momentum to these playoffs, and all of a sudden you don't play for a week. You're trying to get, you know, a worldwide audience here. I mean, you're going to get the people from OKC, the people from Indianapolis, nobody, well, we happen, I happen to know a couple of them from school. You're going to get your gamblers, and you're going to get, you know, 1,000 old people that like basketball. Who else is going to watch it after a week off? I mean, that's being a little sour, but, you know, you lose momentum on these things as more and more cities drop out. Just saying.
That's a good question. I think that, you know, they tried to set the NBA at the beginning of June, and they're holding to it, and it just worked out that it's 5 days this time. I mean, I guess you have to kind of plan, because what happens if the Knicks played last night?
Well, I'm saying,
you know, a Game 7.
You should say whenever the last game ends, it should be 2 days after that. Or three, not a week. It could have been not only a week, it could have been 10 days if they all would have gone four. Right?
True.
What's the point of that? I mean, anyway. Do we have Mr. Flanagan?
You do. Good morning.
John, how are you? Just remember, beware the white man. They come to steal your land.
I love that story.
I had two things that I don't know how it just landed on me this weekend. I don't know if you have, I'm sure you had maybe better things to do, but you weren't watching Channel 9 Saturday night, and they had this big thing about the Japanese internment. which is kind of weird. It was like a 15-minute deal, and I had some lady from Japan with their Japanese lady. She's from Japan. Interviewing, and then I was reading this thing of Audrey's from that group that I quote once in a while, the Heritage Foundation, regarding tariffs. You read this stuff that went on like, you know, 100 years ago or 80 years ago or 150 years ago. John, it's the same story. It's the same program. It is today. I mean, people have always been as big as schmucks, or, you know, as good as they can be and as big as schmucks. They were given a little bit of background to the Japanese story. I mean, for those that, you know, obviously don't read as much or not as interested, when you built the railroad, you needed all this labor. And in the Midwest, the canals and the railroads, not that there weren't other people, nationalities, basically it was the only job you gave the Irish, right? Was digging canals by hand and building railroads. So that when you started west from Council Bluffs, Iowa or Omaha, wherever the hell you were, and went west, it was mostly Irish laborers. When you came east, there weren't that many people in California. And so they ended up letting an awful lot of Asians in, mostly Chinese, to build the railroads, which was basically an absolutely horseshit job. And it was worse than here, because there they were blowing up tunnels. And in the tunnels, I mean, you're using gunpowder. It was before TNT was invented. So, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of these people died. You know, avalanches and you name it. Where in the Midwest, I mean, the Irish drank themselves to death, but I'm sure there were a lot of, you know...
Avalanche deaths.
But there weren't a whole lot of avalanche deaths in Nebraska. But, you know, it wasn't like guys lived to be 80 either. So, when all this was done, you had all these Asian Chinese people here. Well, you know, guess what? We don't want them here anymore, right? Well, a lot of them went north and built the Canadian railroads. And some even, if you ever took the tour up in California of the Beringer Wine Company, which is huge, they have all these tunnels drilled into the mountain where they store the wine. It's always like, what, 55, 58 degrees or whatever the hell's in a tunnel. And the guys that blew the tunnels up for the railroads blew the tunnels up for those guys. But after a while, they didn't really want all these Chinese people here, so they made life kind of miserable, and some of them went back, a lot of them went back to China, which left kind of an opening of a lot of Japanese people. And they came over, and a lot of them became farmers, and, you know, in smaller towns and so forth, and there was some percentage they gave on the show, and I'm going to try and get a copy of it somehow. Some percentage of, like, all the vegetables people ate were grown by Japanese. Then the war starts, and they decided, oh, no, we're going to intern these people. And every book you read about Roosevelt that's somewhat positive pretty much said that he left this whole thing alone, that it was not his idea, he just never opposed it. There was a couple of guys that went forward with this, interning all these people. And they interned a bunch of people who were not citizens yet. They also interned a boatload of people that were citizens, that had been here, it might have been second generation. And they pretty much stole all their stuff, somebody they did, put them in these places with, you know, the clothes you could carry. And they were there for a couple of years, and as time went by, they were able to leave the camps in the daytime and have jobs and stuff. And it wasn't like a German concentration camp, but it wasn't pleasant either. And people lived there and had jobs and so forth. And then when it was over, the lady said they got $25 and a railroad ticket, but not back to like their home. It was to some other place, because their home was like gone. I'm reading this stuff, and the best, Jan, was, you know, everybody talks about the court system. Well, evidently, there were suits that made their way through the court, and by the time it got to the Supreme Court, it was like the end of 43 or something. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't intern citizens without some kind of process. Dawg, does that sound familiar? And they just ignored it, and finally the war ended, and they let everybody out. So they never actually listened to the Supreme Court at all. Even though the court system, you know, supposedly they just totally ignored it. And the weird part is, Roosevelt, nothing in his history would you say it was Franklin Roosevelt's idea to do this. It just got a big flurry up in Congress, and Roosevelt just never put a stop to it. I mean, I read some, and I'm not making 100% correlation, but in terms of dodging responsibility, I watched this German group on TV once. Jan and I were talking about the Holocaust, and they said nowhere in Germans, you know, are pretty good at evidently put writing everything down, right? And said nowhere you can find a piece of paper with Adolf Hitler's name on it that had anything to do with the camps and stuff. You know, if he went through any of his speeches, any of his writings, any of his orders, it was never in there. Yet obviously he must have known about it, right? Since he's the one with Mein Kampf that wrote about it. And yet there was never anything that you could never tie back to him. I mean, obviously you have any sort of a sober judgment you can, but I mean, Roosevelt had nothing to do with these camps, according to him. Yet there they were. And what's the story about the bishop that no mouse could get across his church without him knowing about it, and he was shocked there was gambling downstairs? Bingo.
Well, I think the Roosevelt involvement in this is, you know, yet to be fully explored, because I think he successfully dodged any responsibility for it. But given, you know, how much Roosevelt had to say about everything else that went on in the country, I can't believe this happened without his knowledge and tacit consent. And the Supreme Court upheld the internment camps in the Korematsu decision. So it wasn't like the courts it said one thing and everybody else defied it. No, the courts.
Well, they eventually said you couldn't do it without due process for citizens. You couldn't just pick somebody else.
Upheld in the Korematsu case the way it had been implemented. And it wasn't that these internment camps were unconstitutional, or, you know, extra legislative. No, that was okay. And you know, Tom, my thinking has really changed over the years because reading, you know, the Korematsu decision years ago, I was in college and in a Supreme Court history course, and Hugo Black's, you know, decision in that, he wrote the majority opinion. And this was considered, you know, one of the great stains on an otherwise illustrious, you know, liberal's career.
Well, how do they get from there to the decision later on that said if you were a citizen, they didn't say they were illegal. They said you couldn't put a citizen there without due process. Was that an afterthought decision or what?
Well, it was not really, I don't think, the meat of the decision that got it to the Supreme Court. I mean, it was whether these camps had, you know, legal authority. If this was a legal act to inter people of an ethnicity or a race that was deemed, you know, a danger or a risk to the U.S. And it's very hard today, Tom, you know, to think about what the mood of the country was in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor, and whether that was, you know, engineered or steered, you know, and to what extent by Roosevelt and the State Department to enhance, you know, sympathy towards the U.S. and to get it into the war, which is what Roosevelt really wanted, as the, you know, his 1940 opponent Wendell Willkie, both presidential candidates were itching to get into the war, so all they needed was a pretext. But certainly there was strong evidence that the Japanese were infiltrating businesses and, you know, public opinion, and this was not something that, you know, the country ever.
Yeah, but we didn't have a massive Japanese rally in Madison Square Garden like we did for the Nazis.
Well, but the Japanese were the ones that precipitated the war by the attack, so that they were considered, you know, more hostile at the time than the Germans were, even though you had, you know, genteel Nazi groups in the U.S. in sympathy with the Germans.
Well,
it was
the mentality. The mentality I don't get, though, is after this lady also was mentioning that afterward, the immigration policy was virtually nobody from Asia, nobody from Southern or Eastern Europe, but anybody wanted from Northern Europe. I mean, it was incredibly racially oriented. I mean, sort of
like
today.
Well, that's been going on since the 20s.
Well, it's been going on. It's going on now, for God's sake. I mean, there's people we love and people we don't. People like us, we love, and people aren't like us, we don't like so much. But yeah, I just the thing about, I read a lot about Roosevelt, so have you, obviously. He was absolutely convinced. I mean, I think if you could put 100% of his knowledge on a graph, 90% of it was Europe-focused. I mean, even the running of the war, he pretty much left that totally to the people, you know, the guy, what was the guy's name, head of the Navy in Pearl Harbor. Who am I talking about, John? The the guy who ran the Navy, and after they got rid of the one guy after Pearl Harbor, they put who was in charge. We'll think of it. But he put that in basically in those guys' hands, and he was really hands-on in Europe, because that he was all his. We didn't really have that much information coming out of Japan, but he was really into what was going on in Europe before the war, and there was a certain. It wasn't like he was dying to get into war. He knew, he was convinced the inevitability of it. But Hitler was just not going to stop until somebody got in, and it was either going to be that guy was going to run everything, or we were going to somehow support people to make the world like it is today, whether we like it. Like, I mean, it was pretty obvious to him that this Hitler thing was going to keep going. Even there were people. I mean, just when Churchill got in, he still had all kinds of issues with. People in Britain, when after how many times did Hitler sign a deal and then renege on it 3 days later? And yet there were still people in Britain that were convinced he could make a deal with the guy. I mean, it's pretty scary when you think of it. I mean, Chamberlain didn't just go away. He was still on the group of five that made all the decisions that Churchill had to deal with every day, and he hadn't changed. He was still convinced the guy you could deal with the guy. How could that guy think he could deal with him after his fiasco?
Well, he thought he had avoided war in 1938, and, you know, it was a claim. You know, went back to England waving the accord. This seemed to, like, make war an impossibility, but that only lasted a year. A lot of people felt at the time it would even last that long. But just to go back to the second, one of the things about, you know, it's always an ugly thing when you have a nation that has had limited dealings with a country that it had, you know, I would say spotty political dealings with before the war. And Japan was an upstart country in the eyes of the U.S. and a lot of other countries too. After they shellacked Russia, you know, at the beginning of the century, this kind of woke people up. And the military had pretty much taken control of, you know, the political system starting in the 30s. And you had, you know, the horrors and Manchuria and
it could have been the worst anybody ever did, even like Pol Pot and all these other.
The climate and the very correct image that the Japanese had in this country. I mean, they weren't interested in PR campaigns at the time. They really didn't care what the U.S. thought of them, and as a result, the U.S. you know took and legitimately probably took an extreme position when it came to now having a lot of Japanese-born people, some of them citizens in this country, and now the nation is at war. It was very similar to what happened in World War One with the Germans, and there was you know, they weren't in internment camps in World War One, but there were you know anti-German legislation, no teaching of the German language.
But the mentality ought to be that the people that are here, everybody's here because they left some place because the place sucked. You don't question the Irish.
And that's the bulk of that population, too, yes, but not everybody. And I think there was enough suspicion, and probably enough warranted suspicion, that this was not a good idea not to have these people under surveillance. I'm not trying to justify, given what we know now, you know, and the relationship we supposedly have with Japan and everything else. That's all changed. I can't see the world with the same eyes my grandparents or parents did.
Did you ever read a book? I read most of it. I've got it if you want it. Pearl Harbor Ghosts.
No.
It has to do with, it's almost like Jerome Holzman in the wake of the news. It was talk about what was going on over there. When you know, Japan was, like you say, the stuff that went on in China was unconscionable. I mean, the military class was something like, you know, I'm sure we have seen back in the Middle Ages of people just like to kill people. But in this modern era, it was nothing anybody quite like that people had seen for a while. Now, Hitler came pretty close, and Stalin evidently was always like that, but I just rattled off two other people. But they were so worried, because there was a big Japanese population in Honolulu, they were so worried that the revolt was going to come almost from internally. And one of the reasons why Pearl Harbor was so successful with the Japanese is when they went on alert, they took the planes and some of the bases, a couple of the bases, and instead of having them in the hangars somewhat protected, lined them up in the middle of the field because they thought the citizens were going to show up and blow up the hangars. So when the Japanese showed up to bomb them, they're going, what are these things doing lined up in the middle of the field? But the weird part of it was, John, you're absolutely correct, by the way, as usual, and that the bulk of the population were here because they didn't want to be in Japan. They had no part of the losers that were running the place. And they were Americans, you know, pretty much through and through, just like the Irish and the Italian had become here. But on top of that, though, they had a few spies. By the way, there were a bunch of German spies here. Who do you think gave the Germans all that?
And then industrial sabotage.
Yeah. I mean, the Germans were pretty big on people here sending the Germans when the convoys were leaving, right?
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
So, but I'm sure you've watched, Jimmy, every movie you ever see about Pearl Harbor, right? What's the one scene that's always in every movie? Evidently, there's one road, I've never been there, that comes down from the mountains down to Pearl Harbor. And there's that one, like, what do you want to call it, a siding, for lack of a better term, where everybody, in every movie, some guy's always out there making out with some girl the night before, right? It was the spot where Burt Lancaster, there's like a lookout point going down where you can see the entire harbor. So in the midst of moving planes to the middle and looking suspiciously at all these people, the Japanese actually did have a spy there. And the dude every day, like twice a day, drove up to this lookout point and took a boatload of pictures of Pearl Harbor and sent them to Japan. They never thought to look. The one spot you'd want to take a look and see who is in the harbor is this spot. This guy went up there twice a day for like months, and nobody even saw the guy.
Right.
I mean, so your intelligence, you've got this fear and this hatred of some kind, yet you don't think at all. I mean, duh.
Well, and maybe, you know, in hindsight is always best with this, but the flip side to me, Tom, is that all the military-aged men who were Japanese and in those camps were exempted from U.S. military service. I wish your dad and my dad had a similar gift given.
Now, why didn't they let those guys go to Europe?
They didn't want them in the service at all.
Why?
Because they weren't convinced that they could, you know, take the oath of office, you know, the oath of, you know, your military oath, and actually serve as, you know, somebody they wanted. This is, and it's not surprising. I mean, if you intern people because of their ethnicity, would you really want them in the military, supposedly fighting on your side? I don't think so. No matter where you sent them. But that's a benefit our parents did not get. So nobody in those camps, you know, suffered, you know, the pain, death, whatever that, you know, U.S. military service did. So that was maybe that was part of the, you know, payback for it that, you know, you never hear about.
When I was a youth, before I could even drive, I got a job like working on this guy's yard in Beverly, and I'd go over there 2-3 days a week. This old dude, he's old Austrian guy. His name Otto Koppel. How old German is that? And he was in the army, but when he was Austrian, when World War I broke out, they wouldn't let him go to Europe to fight for fear he'd join the other side. But he was in the army. He was a machine gun instructor, and he fought in the war against Pancho Villa down in Mexico. It wasn't like they didn't draft him. I mean, why not let these guys enlist and send him to Europe?
Well, they did not want them.
That's insanity.
If you're thinking about the internment camps was correct in their eyes, that they're being consistent by saying, well, we don't want, you know.
Well, we had German guys in the army and Italian guys in the army. Right?
Well, we had POW camps for Germans in Florida.
No, I'm talking about we had American citizens that were Italian and German who fought in Europe.
Oh, yeah, and, you know, I'm not saying that this is all, you know, consistent across the board with whatever, you know, immigrant populations the U.S. had, you know.
But if a guy wants to enlist and go fight and die, why would you tell him no?
But if the idea was if we have identified this group as worthy of internment, then we're also exempting their men from military service. And I think that's perfectly consistent.
To me, it's kind of nuts if somebody's a citizen.
We did not intern, you know, other groups, but we did imprison various Italians and Germans, normal people suspected crimes.
We got to get a break here. How do you, if somebody, if all U.S. citizens, males over the age of 19, are liable for the draft. Just because you interred a citizen, he's still a citizen, right? How does he get exempt from the?
I'm just saying, Tom, they were exempted.
I'm saying that's...
If
you didn't say that, Jan, today, and I know you're right, I would never even have dreamed of that. That somehow, if you got plunked in a camp for not even a crime, how you'd be exempt from the draft,
well,
I can't even dream of it.
Tom, would you really want somebody in the service whose parents and siblings were in a internment camp back in California or Oregon? Would you really expect them to be a true blue soldier? I don't think so.
Well, when you say you're exempt, does that mean if you tried to enlist, you couldn't get in?
Right.
That's insane.
You were disqualified. They were not subject to selective service. That's a good deal, Tom. Come on.
I never even thought of it. SP futures down 21. NASDAQ futures down 110. I don't think it came on the same day, Jen.
Well, it may not have, but the end result was this was a...
The day they stole house and car and plunked them in a camp is not the same day. Yeah. Oh, by the way, the flip side is your kid doesn't have to go in the Army. I don't think that was the flip side. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
What are you going to do with your old car? You can try selling it, you could junk it, or you can donate it to Heritage for the Blind. Your car will be towed away for free, and your donation is tax deductible. Just call 1-800-639-8620. Heritage for the Blind accepts cars, vans, trucks, and boats. It doesn't matter if your vehicle runs or not, it'll be towed away for free, and you'll be supporting those that need help. Heritage for the Blind is a nonprofit organization that helps the visually impaired live fuller lives. Call right now to donate your car. And as a special thank you for calling, you'll receive a free 3-day vacation voucher to many exciting locations. Call Heritage for the Blind right now. Call 1-800-639-8620. Donating is easy, and your vehicle is towed away for free. Plus, you'll get a free vacation voucher. Call now, 1-800-639-8620. That's 1-800-639-8620.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now.
I'm shocked to find that gambling is going on in here.
You're winning, sir.
Oh, thank you very much.
John, why do I get the feeling that our buddy Jim Lawler could have played that part? Claude Rains. You're winning, sir. Oh, yes.
Well, whenever I see Claude Rains in any movie, I always kind of forget who else is in this.
Yeah. They had some scene stealers in that movie, him and Cindy Greenstreet.
Oh, God. What's his name? Peter Lorre?
Yeah.
The same group from Maltese Falcon. And then you had, Paul Henreid and... Ingrid Bergman, can we forget Ingrid Bergman?
Yeah. She was, I don't know if people remember, but she was in For Whom the Bell Tolls.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And what they did in those days, what were your collaborators for the women, they shaved their head, right?
Yeah.
Well, she looked good with her head shaved. Most people look like they got a lumpy head, but not her.
You couldn't spoil those looks.
No lumps
on her. Yeah.
I could see Matt Byrne growing up to be in a Sydney Greenstreet. What do you think? There's always incidental expenses. Yes, yes.
I'm in better shape for it.
By the way, Mr. Byrne just watched the movie first time. Matt, what were your impressions, bud?
Oh, man. Honestly, I will say the movies channel's been playing it a bunch lately, so I've been rewatching it. I really enjoy it. I think it's a movie you got to watch more than once. It's kind of a lot of atmosphere. You know, it's a good film, definitely.
There's some stuff, and I've watched it, you know, a bunch of times, but I actually saw this thing. It was about a half hour long. Talk about all the different stuff that people don't do with color photography anymore. There's a scene when she was looking for the bolt of cloth. She's looking at it, and the guy kept going, you know, for friends of Rick's. He dropped the price then for special friends of Rick's. Mm. Well, if you look at her blouse, the light was coming through the church steeple, and there was a cross on her chest. That was in the with a background that they did on purpose.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, but you see that stuff. What's his name was huge on that too, Hitchcock.
Yeah.
And evidently, people could do a lot more in. Well, color's better, obviously, if you're watching a movie.
Black and white is better for many other things.
So yeah, for what do they call it? Subliminal almost, or what do you want to call it? It's we don't even know you're seeing it, but then when you look at it,
light and shadow really become symbolic in black and white in a way they can't be in color.
It's the last movie I saw in black and white long after that there were color movies. Remember, was it like the Last Picture Show?
Yeah.
That was a boy. Talk about a dark movie, huh? Not only because it was in black and white, but just it was just basically this Texas town just goes down.
Yeah, the death of this culture really.
Yeah. It was all personified in one guy, Ben Johnson.
Yeah.
And he ended up where he was going to marry this one lady, and then he didn't, and she, and what the, even the place where they went fishing, the kid goes, there's no fishing, there's not even a lake. He says, well, there used to be, and there used to be fish. even the lake was gone. It was brutal.
Jeff Bridges in that.
Yeah, Timothy Bottoms.
Yes. Sybil Shepherd.
Sybil Shepherd was, boy, she was young, and Didn't she have to take all her clothes off on the diving board or something at one point there and there? Not that I remember.
There's a whole cult that's grown up around that film.
I think it's one of the best. But it's one of those dark movies you can only watch a couple times.
The one I put alongside that too, even darker, is Spy Who Came After Me from the Cold.
Oh God, you can't watch.
I can't imagine that movie in color. Also.
No, I can't. I mean, there's also what am I talking about? The guy was in From Here to Eternity. Burt Lancaster was in a movie called The Train.
Oh yeah!
Don't even watch. You can't even watch it. So many people were getting machine gunned. It was brutal.
And,
or the Pawnbroker with Rod Steiger. Oh, yeah. That can't make a color film like you know that same story. And
well, the thing that made this one the Train, Matt or Jimmy, if you ever get a chance, well, say if you get a chance to watch it, probably don't. That was it for a lead-in, but. It had to do with, you know, with people expecting to be killed. You know, which was so weird. He was the head of one of the resistance groups in France, and they evidently very successful, and he had a name for himself among the French. Well, the Germans had gotten all these. They stole all the art from some museum, right, John?
Yeah.
And stuffed it on this train. They were going to take the train back to Germany. And basically sell his stuff because you know, Germany was starting to lose the war. And the underground people, the people who ran the museum, came to Burt Lancaster and they said, well, you know, you need to save this art. And he goes, like, it's just art. And I used to have, 20 people in my group? John, and he says, we're down to 8 or 9. Or the other one of my friends, they're all dead. He says, I don't feel like sacrificing another 5 or 6, essentially, for art. And she goes on to this huge thing about it. It's not just art, it's the soul of France and this and that. And I think, well, he finally does agree to do it for her, and sure enough, how many more of his buddies get knocked off, right, Jen? You know, so it was essentially a bargain people for art. And, you know, when you think of it that way, it's not just, most war movies are people just march off, there's no decision to be made. You know, you go, you get battle, some people die, some people don't. I mean, as bad as it is, there's decisions among the generals, right, John? But among the rest of the people, there really isn't. So here you're actually going through the mind of somebody going, I'm going to lose like the rest of my friends if I do this. It's troubling, to say the least, isn't it?
Oh, the remember the bombing of the of Monte Cassino in Italy?
Yeah.
Which was, you know, Thomas Aquinas' abbey, you know, and the Germans had holed up in it. And they filmed the attack on it, but they destroyed this, you know, 12th century, you know, landmark. This is what happens in war. That was one of many instances like that in all wars where art, you know, had to, you know, bow down to mammon, or, you know, the other things had to be put in the balance, and this was a good trade-off. So
one of the most, have you ever read George Marshall's Soldier and Statesman?
No, I have not, but it's a legendary book.
It's, yeah, I mean, he was, what gave him acclaim, even though people already knew he was the Pete Crow Armstrong of the military in sense of logistics, and a lot of it was, I use the term, beaten into him, because he was in, I mentioned a friend of mine was at the war against Pancho Villa. Well, when he came in, he led a cavalry, talk about, you know, something like out of John Wayne, group out to get these Mexican bandits in southern Texas. And he led this group out there. They're out there for a month. Didn't see a soul, much less a bandit. Came back. The average guy lost like 12 or 15 pounds, and they were all in good shape when they left. And he said never again is he going anywhere or ordering people to go anywhere without any kind of intelligence of where the hell the enemy actually was. Plus, they didn't have supply. The guys were supposed to bring him food, didn't. It was basically a goat bleep. He goes, I'm never gonna do that again. And in the Spanish-American War, the ships took off with the soldiers for Cuba. An hour or two before the fresh produce ship showed up to put the, they left without half the chow. He goes, I'm never gonna do that again either. You know, so his logistical knowledge came from being in positions where the stuff didn't match up right, and people were either hungry or died or something. So in World War One, he made a name for himself when the Americans showed up, the doughboys, right, Jay?
Yeah.
The French, of course, just wanted to throw them on the front to get machine gunned down like the French. Fortunately, our generals were smart enough going, we're not doing that. And he said basically all the French generals that they had studied at the war college turned out to be a bunch of idiots in his mind. Well, his job was if they were going to fake the Germans out. The Americans were going to attack in the middle of the front, and then in the morning pull back and move like 5 miles one way and outflank the front. But in the meantime, it was a two-lane dirt road with all the people in France, you know, with their ox carts and stuff on it. So his job was to logistically move an entire division from the middle of the front to the end in like 5 hours and then attack there in the afternoon. And somehow he pulled it off. And he was only, I don't even think he was a major. He might have been a first lieutenant, but he might have been a major. But they said he was the guy who pulled it off. So he did, and the Americans come around the end, and it was one of the days in World War One where the war essentially turned. It was the most heroic battle and blah, blah, blah. So at the end of the day or the next day, somebody says to him, aren't you happy with the results? And he goes, what are you talking about? 9 of my best friends are dead. What do you mean happy with the results? What's the matter with you? I remember that line. I'll never forget it, John. What is the matter with you? 9 of my best friends are dead. He goes, yeah, well, we won. He goes, well, they didn't. Basically, right? I mean, you got, yeah,
don't charge the life brigade for George Marshall.
Yeah, I mean, he's like, well, what are you talking about? There's no honor here. I mean, there's some satisfaction that it could have been a lot worse if we didn't do as well as we could, but there's no honor here, right? I mean, there isn't.
No.
And from those days forward, he said, if I'm going to send somebody into war, he's going to have all the bullets he needs, all the food he needs, all the toilet paper he needs, everything he needs to have the best chance to come out of there in one piece. Now, there were a lot of mistakes after that, mostly made by Eisenhower, who became president, which is more bizarre, but anyway.
Agreed.
I mean, he made, anyway. Hey, what did you think of the stuff I was talking about on tariffs earlier? You probably know about the revolt that was at South Carolina had against the U.S. regarding tariffs, where they...
Yeah, it was a kind of dry trial run for the Civil War.
Yeah.
The same issues really erupted, you know, years later. But that was, it was an outgrowth. I mean, there had been tariffs early on in the Continental Congress days to, you know, pay for the the war. I mean, the colonies were in tough shape financially and meeting recruitment, you know, quotas and everything else, and quelling mutinies. Things were really pretty tough. So they needed to raise money and pay these soldiers and stuff. So tariffs became, you know, part of a strategy in the 1780s, 90s. But then in the 1820s, the British were flooding the U.S. with cheaper stuff than the, you know, U.S. manufacturers could sell, because they were trying to rebuild and, you know, take advantage of the fall of Napoleon and get, you know, back into trade routes that they had been denied while they had to deal with Napoleon. So they were just, you know, dumping stuff pretty much. And the U.S. retaliated with tariffs to, you know, enable the American manufacturers to compete. And it infuriated the Southerners, who were dependent on, you know, exporting their cotton and, you know, textile products to Europe, and especially Britain, which had a huge appetite for this stuff. So that this put them at a disadvantage. At the time, Andrew Jackson was president, but his predecessor, John Quincy Adams, had signed the tariffs into law. Jackson felt obligated to enforce them, but his vice president was John Calhoun of South Carolina, who was, you know, infuriated by these, and, you know, eventually resigned as vice president and returned to the Senate.
Didn't South Carolina essentially refuse to collect them?
Yeah, the nullification crisis was like a couple of years later, after some of these tariffs had been ramped up, and then eventually they were abated, you know, over time in a compromise action. But it had peaked in 1832, where South Carolina had said it wasn't going to abide by these tariffs and was defying.
Well, when you say abide by them, every port of entry, this is what I befuddles me, that a slice of the population, I can't estimate too big, has no clue what tariffs are. When something shows up, you charge the person for importing it, and you send the dough to Washington. It's the tax on you, and I don't think, you know, a significant percentage of the population is clear on that. So what South Carolina said, okay, you got a tariff thing, but guess what? When it shows up, the people in South Carolina, we're not collecting it, and we're not sending you the dough, right?
Yeah.
And the president, was it Jackson, said if you don't, we're going to invade, essentially,
we're
right?
Sending the troops. Yeah, we're going to do this under firepower. Well, you know, Henry Clay sort of diffused this tension, but it created tremendous bad will, especially between South Carolina. And, you know, it isn't accidental that, you know, it was, you know, Fort Sumter is in South Carolina.
Well, if you can imagine, you know, say California, for instance, we don't like Trump, we don't agree with him. Guess what? Container comes into our port, we're not collecting, and we're not sending it to you. It's the same thing, right?
Right. Well, you know, you look at the history of, you know, the nullification movement, you know, in, you know, the school desegregation in Little Rock in the 50s, where Eisenhower sent in the troops to desegregate Little Rock schools because of defying the Brown versus Board of Education Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, did they ever send troops in Alabama, or was that just National Guard?
I think it was the National Guard. That's when, and Ole Miss too.
Yeah, yeah.
They were desegregated. I there was a threat to do that, because that was under, you know, that was in the Kennedy era, and there were threats to bring in troops. And I think Kennedy was reluctant to do that because, you know, he was dealing with a Southern culture that is hard to kind of imagine today, where he was hanging on to the Democrats.
Well,
he needed them.
People our age can imagine it. We saw it.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, it's a similar thing, Tom, with the whole movement towards sanctuary cities, which is, to me, an even more brazen, you know, declaration of opposition to, you know, the enforcement of, you know, U.S. law, and in many cases state law too. But, you know, it's just been decided locally that you can defy the greater powers and act with impunity. It's a shame that the sanctuary movement, city movement, got started and flourished and was not opposed earlier on more strongly. Because now we're dealing with a situation where after, you know, a decade of out of control, you know, lack of border control and sanctuary cities, you've got a culture now that's it's really hard to get back to something like you didn't have to put up with in the first place. But, you know, this is now, it's a successor to the nullification movement. And, you know, the thing about the Civil War, it's easy to lose sight of, the whole idea of seceding from the Union, that was the precipitating act that, that caused the U.S. to put, you know...
Well, Lincoln justified that by the Articles of Articles of Confederation, not the Constitution.
Yeah.
But the, you might, because you might ask yourself, the state voted to join, can the state vote to leave?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a, you know, it's a, I mean, I'm glad they didn't, but I'm not so sure that I could have argued the other side all that much either.
Well, the lack of any, you know, mechanism to do this doesn't mean that it's not legally impossible. It just means it's not prescribed how this would happen. Do you do it by vote? Do you do it by military action? You know, how do you enforce it? You know, what does this do to the remaining concord between the other states? Of course, the Civil War did not settle that issue at all.
Well, but your states always... I actually read something on this once, John. It had to do with... the guys from Texas, they always want to leave, right? And we had to do what would Texas leave? I mean, actually, I've also read a bunch of... You probably have, too. In a few minutes, we'll talk about the market, but... had to do what if the South would have seceded? They'd have been screwed. They had no economy. They had no central bank. They had... Their currency was crap. I mean, I had read the same. If you fast forward the South 150 years, where would they be? And they basically said it'd be a third world country. Now, I don't know if it's that severe, but I mean, there would, you know, what's Texas going to do if all of a sudden we don't send them all the stuff we send them? They think they're so independent. Are they really? I mean, are they really? Could they have their own treasury? Could they have their own everything? All the stuff that people essentially do for them. Can they have their own army? I mean, what if Mexico invades, and we don't help them? Could they really think they can do that? I mean, you got to use your head with this stuff too a little bit.
Well, and the South would have used its head if they had seceded en masse, and if the U.S. hadn't opposed it with military action. Or threatened, you know, and then of course the South fired the first shot. Remember, but had it just devolved where we're not fighting a war over this. You go your own way, you know. If you want diplomatic relations, send your ambassador.
Okay,
to
but then who got the West? They get none of it. There's a lot of issues.
Right, and it had the South, you know, actually, you know, left peaceably, and you know, had all of the issues. The required money and manufacturing and everything else to build railroads and develop the West, the South wouldn't have been able to do it without participation, great assistance from their former enemies in the North. I have a hunch that for however long the South would have stayed out of the Union, they would have come, you know, back hat in hand.
Yeah, I would think so too. Well, especially, I mean, who got California? I think it was going to be the North.
Right, instead we lost how many lives? And created more bad feeling, you know, to get a result that to this day seems that, you know, not to be fully settled. So I don't know it was such a good deal. I mean, Lincoln...
When is war ever a great deal?
Well, I'm using that somewhat ironically.
Yeah.
No war is a great deal.
Even today, I mean, you have, you know, a lot of, you know, I don't know if I'm on this road, but a lot of the reparations talk and how horrible slavery was and everything, but Nobody ever talks about the guy from Ohio that never saw a slave, never wanted a slave, never anything. By the way, came back without a leg or without a life. I mean, there was a lot of people that gave off a lot on both sides. I mean, how many people died from measles in these camps that never even saw a plantation, for God's sake?
Right. Well, a lot of them are buried in the south side of Chicago.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of those people did not want to be in the military at all.
No.
They had very little to defend. They didn't have any money. To them, this was just, you know, their duty, but it was a miserable existence. They get sick at Camp Douglas in Chicago, and they're treated horribly. and they ended up getting buried in mass graves in the South Side. Did any of those people really deserve that? I don't know. I don't see them any differently from the Union soldiers.
I think we should be very happy we weren't alive there in the 1800s. Even if you were rich, you had nothing but health problems, right?
Yeah.
It was pretty much an awful
life expectancy of 45 or 50 at the most.
So what did you think of the tariff discussion I was talking about earlier, where the dude, he followed it up with the stuff we've been talking about, the old, and he mentioned that, you know, South Carolina thing, but the idea that with the original general agreement of tariff on trade was probably the best document economically the world ever put together. Is the one fly in the ointment was probably letting China in.
Yeah.
But that the other people, he said, pretty much have all owned up to it. But, you know, it was weird, though. He kind of was showing his conservative roots a little bit, talking about how unfair the Japanese, actually, they don't have a tariff on U.S. cars, but Germany, Europe does. But he said basically Japan wants no part of U.S. cars. They all sucked. They got way too little gas miles. They were too big. But I remember going to Europe in 1988 for a wedding, of all things. And everybody, we were in Amsterdam, and we went through Germany up to Denmark. I didn't see an American car there. I couldn't imagine an American car being there. Everybody was driving little rabbit diesels or Volkswagens. Remember those cars? Maybe Jimmy, you ever heard of something called a student Jag?
No.
It was this ugly-ass little car that you'd see in all these old movies. It was about as big as a Volkswagen. It was made by Peugeot, I think. But the headlights looked like something out of the 20s. They were totally separate from the body, those big, huge headlights. The thing, if you wanted to start it, and the thing didn't start, somebody got behind and gave it a shove, and it went in gear. And they literally, I think the three of us could pick one up. That's what everybody drove, the streets. I looked at a couple of streets, I go, I couldn't even get my Bronco down the street. The American cars had no business there. It wasn't like the tariff was a problem. I mean, look at the city of Amsterdam. It looks like central Boston, only worse. You can't be driving around pickup trucks down. I mean, I don't know that the tariff was that big of a deal versus, because actually one of the biggest selling cars in Europe for a while wasn't the piece of crap that GM made here for an Opel. Weren't Opels really big in Europe for a while?
Yeah, was that Buick or the GM car?
It was a GM car, but it was a tiny little thing that nobody ever wanted here. They're actually a big hit over in Europe. But those cars, they were unsafe. They were, I mean, China, there wasn't a crash thing, there wasn't an airbag, there was nothing on any of those things.
Dude, the car manufacturers could have made a fortune sending Gremlins and, you know, Pintos overseas.
Yeah, but, you know, but I think they were too smart. They didn't want that crap, basically. I mean, yeah, so I mean, anyway, this guy's point was China's been the fly in the ointment. All they want to do is steal other people's stuff and all that kind of crap. And by the way, you know, the part about the purpose in Korea or South Vietnam making less, well, that's their advantage. They have more labor. They don't, but their disadvantages, they don't have power, they don't have all the other stuff that we have. So people there are willing to work for less, but it's more than they can make other places. You know, by the way, as the years go by, they're going to become more and more affluent and make more and more as they start getting the marginal return on labor. I mean, if you look, labor theory, which I'm not about to go into now because I have Nancy coming in, it has to do with you pay people and you keep hiring people until the last person matches the amount he actually makes for you. Then you stop. I don't know if you ever had one of those classes, John, but that's when you stop. So if you got all this stuff and you put one guy in there and you're paying him $20 an hour and he's making you $200 because he's got this whole machine and everything else, you say, wait a minute, we better put another guy in that machine. Okay. Then you put a third guy. Well, now the third guy is only getting you $50 an hour, but you're still paying him $20. So you essentially keep hiring until the last guy exactly equals the 20, right?
Yep.
So his you're still benefiting at least from what you're paying him. I mean, when you hear all these politicians and people, even in CNBC and something, did anybody, when they start talking about labor economics, did anyone ever read a book or take a course? Or is that not, you're not supposed to do that anymore? You're supposed to have an opinion?
Who reads, Tom?
Why would anybody read? SP Futures down 24, NASDAQ Futures down 132. We'll have Nancy in a second. And Audrey was showing me at this wedding about how much males don't know about what females are doing is most of the time, and maybe we're better off not knowing. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
Hello, this is Tom Howell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Individuals and businesses with tax problems, listen carefully. Do you feel like you're losing control of your finances? If you owe over $10,000 in back taxes or have unfiled tax returns, we can help you take back control. The IRS is the largest and most aggressive collection agency in the world, and they can seize your bank accounts, garnish your paycheck, close your business, and file criminal charges. Take control of your tax problem now by calling the experts at U.S. Tax Shield and take advantage of the Fresh Start program and new laws that allow us to negotiate a settlement for the lowest amount possible. Our Better Business Bureau A-rated team of tax attorneys and enrolled agents can stop collections and get you protected so you can take control of your financial future. Call now for a free case review and a low price guaranteed quote to get you protected today. Call now, 800-388-4901. That's 800-388-4901. U.S. Tax Shield, 800-388-4901.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349-3456. That's 708-349-3456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Low and low pay Stocks and Jacks. Matt Byrne on the board. SP futures down 22. NASDAQ futures down 119. We were down more, but now we've been pretty much steady here for an hour and a half, right about this number. Dow futures down 127. This is probably predicated a little bit on Trump talking about doubling the steel tariff tax to Europe, which I absolutely do not understand. After last week, everybody was jumping up and down. What a great deal was Nippon taking over U.S. Steel. Isn't that why you put tariffs on to protect your own people? Somehow the inconsistencies here. Anyway, DAX down 88. These guys have come back. They were down more earlier, 0.4%. Matter of fact, they were down almost 1% earlier. Kekron down 38.5%. FTSE up 5, say 0.1%. So the only thing down over in Europe heavy is the auto stocks are down 2% as the tariffs, evidently I think that somehow it's going to move over into more tariffs on cars. Over in Asia, these guys are down a bunch. So Nikkei down 494, 1.3%. Hang Seng down 131.6%. Shanghai actually down 15. It's 0.5%. Those guys actually are doing some movement. Bonds up 2 basis points, 4.34. These guys just keep creeping to the upside, and that's one of the little red flags I've got on this market is these interest rates. The Bund up 3 basis points, 2.53. Oil, big mover in the morning. Oil's up 285. That's almost 5%. 63.64, highest we've seen that in a while. Even though OPEC increased their production, Saudi did a while ago. It was more Saudi than OPEC. But now OPEC Plus is not an increase in their output. So the OPEC Plus Russia in total, then, I guess, they're going to that means they're going to cut back because Saudi went up. I mean, it's for the detail. We'll talk about tomorrow. Natural gas up 23 cents, 367. RBOB up 6 cents, 207. Gold up 72 bucks, 33.61. Silver up 55 cents, 33.57. Copper up 20. Copper, it's almost a 5% move, up 23 cents, 490. Copper pushing 5 hours. That would be something. Foreign exchange, British pound up to over 114 now. I mean, the euro up to 114. Size, we've seen that in a while. British pound over 135. Dollar's been sinking. Crypto down 992, still at 104.117. We got quick traffic, weather, sports, and we'll get to Nancy.
Absolutely. Yes, currently 7:37 a.m. on June 2nd, 2025. Let's look at traffic real quick. Inbound on the Kennedy from O'Hare to Jane Byrne Interchange at 55 minutes. Meanwhile, outbound is at 76, 20-minute difference there. Inbound on the Dan Ryan from 95th to the JB Interchange at 25 minutes. Outbound at 11. Let's look at weather real quick. 54 degrees at Midway and 56 at O'Hare. High of around 84 today with cloudy skies. Mostly sunny skies today. Tonight, partly cloudy and a low of 68. Meanwhile, over in Phoenix, 67 degrees right now. Today, clouds yielding to sun with some spots of showers and a high of 93 degrees. Quickly at sports, MLB yesterday, White Sox lost to Orioles 3-2. Meanwhile, Cubs beat Reds 7-3. Sox play Tigers in Chicago tonight at 6:40 p.m. Cubs will be back on Tuesday night with the Nationals. Meanwhile, we'll see Diamondbacks win against the Nationals 3-1 yesterday. And very quickly, NBA Finals Game 1 this Thursday, June 5th. Pacers are set to go against Thunder at 7:30 p.m. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you.
We have Nance?
We do indeed.
Hey, Nance, how are you?
Hey, how are you?
Doing all right. Your friend dragged me to a wedding on Saturday where she's the only person I knew.
Really?
Yeah. It was nice, though. It was fine, you know.
Well, that's good. Yeah. I heard that she was starvingly hungry.
Imagine that. So we grab a drink. It's outside, right, at this place, way the hell down in Lockport. And, you know, and there's these, those little tables, so we grab a table, and these two ladies come next to us, a young lady and an older lady. Young lady's got this, you know, kind of wild hairdo and a bunch of tats. And she was the hairdresser to everybody. Now, who knows more? Who knows more about people's lives, the bartender or the hairdresser, you think?
The hairdresser.
Probably. So she kind of...
The hairdresser.
So she kind of launches into this thing about marriage as the day of the wedding... how much women are doing versus guys. And so all the guys are doing is sitting around, had too much drink the night before, so they decided to not go play golf. Where the girls, she went to the hotel where they were staying, she and the other, her friend hairdresser, she goes to the one with all the different color hair. Well, then she came by, and she did have different color hair. And it's about 65 degrees out. And of course, all the ladies are dressed in a small amount as they could, and everybody's sniveling about how it's not warm enough, and they're all cold. I get that. Then talk about how much, it must have had 10 people in the bridal party, women. She was there doing everybody's hair in the morning. God knows what time she got there. And everybody looked great. It was a really nice group. And I'm looking at going, oh, you know, the long hair is back in. She goes, those are all extensions. I didn't know that. They all look like they had these movie star hairdos. They look great, and he goes, "No, those are all extensions. No wonder they were going crazy all morning. It takes forever to do that. There's like 8 girls." I'm sitting there going, "Oh, I don't know any about this stuff. I don't. I'm sure I even want to know what's going on."
Yeah, really.
way too much intrigue for the average male. Anyway, it was a nice time, nice place, and actually, it was at this one of those kind of Halloween joints, Jen, that they put up for. You make all this money where the kids go in there for Halloween, and they have weddings in one of the buildings. It was nice. I mean, kind of out. You got to drive past all these old tractors on this stone road to get to a wedding. It's kind of weird, but it was nice. the things people do, Nance. You know.
I guess so. I don't even know how she knew they were extensions.
On those. She goes, the girl did a beautiful job. Okay, then. So there you go.
Oh, wow. But
she knew a lot about everybody. Let's put it that way. She's been a hairdresser for years. God. I remember the movie Shampoo. Warren Beatty.
I don't even remember that.
Oh, God. It's
great movie.
It's a great movie. I don't think they could play it today. I mean, but anyway. So, Nance, what's going on in your world? The interest rates were coming back down. Now they're creeping back up. I got the 30-year pushing 5 again at 4.96. And the TNX, which is the 10-year, went down to 4.2. Now it's creeping back up to 4.4. So you have to believe you might have got a few days where the mortgage rates went down and now they're creeping the other way again. Is that what you saw on your end?
No, pretty much no one's doing anything as far as I can tell. So, I'm like the Maytag repairman. Remember him? He used to sit in the commercials and say, be sleeping and reading the paper, doing crosswords.
Well, you know, if you had a Maytag washer, it was a pretty accurate commercial. They were pretty well made back in the day. Actually,
That I don't remember, but I know that the poor repairman just never had anything to do, and it was sad.
God. Well, I mean, Odd's got some business, but it's all at the I won't say the upper end, but it's the cash end. People that have lived in a house for a while, and I mean, actually a lot of business, but it's most of it is people living in a house for a while and deciding they want to get a different place, but the place has been paid off, and they take their money and go buy another place, and the place they buy bigger, the person there is downsizing, and they take their cash and go buy a condo, cash, and that's kind of what's feeding her. And she has a few other people that are doing mortgages and stuff, but mostly it's this kind of cash trading, isn't it, that's going on?
Yeah, it is. And you can't blame people for wanting to do cash at all. I mean, that only makes sense, right? It is what it is. The it seems the people that have money are doing extremely well, and the people that don't are not. I mean, that just seems to be the way it is, and what can you say about that?
It's not like we ever talk about that, eh?
No, it's just hard. It's really hard right now for people, and it's not hard if you don't want to move. It's hard if you want to move. That's where I, you know, what I see.
Well, it's really hard if you're paying rent.
Well, yeah, that's a whole nother issue and a half, but I do see that people are trying their best to, they're looking, there's a lot of lookers, let's put it that way, but the actual succession of something closing is not really happening. So, and it's just because people are looking though. They are looking, and if it is turnkey, it's tending to go more than it's not.
Well, so, you mentioned, you've turned my whole view on that around, I don't know if you know that or not.
I mean, I did not know that. Well, wow, I changed Tom's mind on something.
You know what? My mind gets changed all the time. The more you learn, the more you realize, hey, I might not have been right yesterday. But I'm at least willing to say that. Not many are, I don't think.
I would agree with that. I would agree with you there.
I mean, the original thought, especially somebody who used to, like, remodel homes, I mean, not a lot, but a few, my thought is somebody wanted to move in condition, the first thing would go into your brain, even though it's totally wrong. Yeah. They're lazy and don't know how to turn a wrench. Well, that's not really true. It means that they put everything down on the mortgage and don't have the money to do it afterward, right?
Correct. That is correct.
And I'm saying, my view has evolved, John, hasn't it?
Yeah. Everybody's asked how.
Yeah.
I mean, we live in strange times.
Yeah, I mean, I don't see how, I mean, the average, I mean, my buddy Doc, nice, he probably still does a few closings, says, you know, I can't believe, this was years ago, he said, I can't believe everybody puts their last dime down on this. The last one I did, we went out for drinks, I had to buy the last nickel went down on the mortgage. And I mean, there's no way you can the next day say, by the way, your air conditioner doesn't work. I mean, God.
Well, if you do, that's not considered a necessity like a water heater might be.
You're saying it's more important to take a shower than it is to be cool.
That's correct. I mean, you can only do what you can do, so.
Yeah, that's true. So, you've been on a while, you know, not years or anything, but we've talked about how many people back in the, you know, the 2%, well, interest rates got down to damn near zero. Mortgages 2-3 or maybe a hair lower if you were lucky. We're now pushing several years since that, Nance. I mean, there was a time when I think you, I remember what you say, believe it or not, I think you said something like, what, 70% or 75% of all mortgages were under 3.5.
90% are under 4. 90% are under 4, and that's still true.
It has to be creeping a little down. There has to be some people that got either croaked or got divorced or did something. I mean, if it topped at 90, I'm going to guess it's got to be down to 84 or 80 or something. Because you're doing something. We have people that moved, right?
Yeah, but like you said, they're paying cash.
Okay. So,
I mean, just this weekend we did an open house, and it's for seven figures plus, and the purchaser is going to pay cash.
Wow.
Yeah. Speechless. See? John, you could pay me to get on now and keep Tom quiet.
Wow.
There you go. Well,
yeah, they're paying cash.
Well,
I'm not saying that it isn't like I'm not, you know, or I'm not working or we're not making loans. That's not it. It's just the majority of the people that are buying really are paying cash.
Well,
it's just a big cash swapping thing going on right now. That's who's moving.
Well, let me rephrase. Out of all those people that has to be pushing 3 years ago now, maybe four, they got all those rates at that. With every year going by, how much of the I've got this place forever at 3%, I'm never moving, how much does that degrade? Because people end up having to move for some reason or end up getting it has to be dropping a little bit.
Then they're renting.
Okay.
So that's not helping. I mean, it's just not helping me, guys. It's not that it's not moving. The thumb is moving. But they're paying cash. They're going to renting then.
Are you still getting people doing refis because of other debts?
I have, but they haven't gone through. I mean, I have, but something crazy has gone on where the deal where there's just absolutely nothing you can do about it.
What we're talking about is a lot of people that may have
like
the three...
Home they devalued the homes.
Okay.
I have no idea what that's about because I don't believe it's really true, but there's nothing you can do when you go get an appraisal and that happens.
Yeah.
I mean, a home fell in a year, $10,000? Really?
Well, is that an area thing?
I don't think it had anything to do with anything. It doesn't make any sense. Sometimes some things happen and you just don't understand it. That was one of them. I didn't understand it.
Well,
at all.
Yes. What do you do when areas when it look? How can I phrase this? You almost need the prices to go up for them to stay even. And that's going to sound really stupid, but. Aud was telling me, you know, I get this information from you ladies, even though you don't necessarily think how smart you guys are. I mean, she was talking about the area around 103rd and Central Park where all these condos went for sale for, let's say, $165 20 years ago. And the whole area kind of sold out and everybody loved being there. Well, now they're going for like $145. Well, this is a couple years ago. And I said, does that mean that the prices are going down? She goes, no, it's... doesn't mean that at all. What it means is the person has lived there for 20 years. The bathrooms and the kitchens, which are the key places that wear out, look like somebody's lived there for 20 years. You need to spend $20,000 to get them back up to what it looked like when the first person moved in. So it's $20,000 worth of wear and tear. The price really hasn't gone down. I mean, is that... And I'm sitting there going, I never even thought of that. So when somebody buys a house that's new... 10 years later, is bitching because they sold it for the same price and never put a dime into it. They actually have made money, right?
In my mind, Jeff. In their mind, no.
Yes. But, I mean, all of a sudden, okay, look at those windows. They look pretty crummy. The bathrooms look pretty crummy. So does the kitchen. You almost need $50,000 to get it back up to where it was when the person moved in, right?
In my opinion, yes. But, see, these people feel that they should make money no matter what, and it just sometimes it just doesn't work that way. But as you're saying, my view would be that yes, they did make money because they bought and they never put a dime into it, and yet they used it. There was wear and tear, and they feel that they, you know, kind of got screwed. And it's like, well, not really. I mean, you live there, you use it, you didn't put any money into it. To me, it's no different than like renting. But you did, you still had your asset and it sold.
Well, I mean, I think what the economic lesson there is, they are not thinking of, I was going to say, are clueless of, the fact that this inflation has really been there for 25 years, if you have assets. So the idea that you could buy something, 10 years later, sell it for the same price, even though you basically wore it out. I mean, if you bought a car, put 100,000 miles on it, and sold it for the same thing you bought it for, you'd look at yourself in the mirror and go, how did that happen, right?
I'm a genius, huh?
Yeah, I'm a genius. But, I mean, same thing with a house, you think you deserve it, correct?
Yeah, it's just really weird. I had somebody the other day who we're going to have to finagle the money around, you know, in order to make things right. But one of the things I want the guy to do is put less money down on the house and buy a car, because his car is from 2011. It's got 188,000 miles on it. And well, I said, it's sooner or later, you're going to get a car payment. So why don't we figure out what it is you want to buy, all right? Look for used cars, do this, do that, because some of that money's got to go towards a car. And he said, well, I just bought this. It was hilarious. He said, I just bought this repair policy for, I don't know, let's say it was like $3,000. So no matter what goes wrong, they're going to replace it. And they said, they're not even going to find parts to replace it.
Hey, wait a minute. Mine's older than that. Careful.
Okay. But you're not trying to buy a house and put all your money down and then try and True. Be able to save either. I mean, I'm just looking at it for down the road. And then he said, well, what do you think I'm going to get for the car? He said, I've got a problem now. See, this is what really started. He's got a problem with the car. And he realizes he may have to buy a car. So I'm saying, let's just get this out of the way so we know what we're dealing with. And he said, well, I got to get the car repaired so I get more money when I trade it in. I said, dude, I don't think this car is going to have any more value, whether you
I can't imagine what I would have had to done to the Suburban to get more value.
Yeah,
it was just at 250, it just was done. It was just done.
Well, that's what I was trying to say. It's not going to matter. I said, call the company and find out if you can just get a refund on what you paid. You're going to get more money that way than you are for your car.
I wonder.
He found that so hard to believe. And then at night, I said, just go out and look. Go out and look. Go to a dealership. Ask them how much your car's worth. And they said it's really worth nothing. Maybe they give you $300 for it. Yeah. I'm like, there you are.
Yeah, there you go.
And he said, how are they going to give me money back? I said, you didn't use the policy. You didn't use it.
You get, what do you get, 90 days or 30 days or something, John? What do you get, to renege on these?
No, they would prorate it even if it went longer than that, wouldn't they, John?
I think so.
Yeah, so that's what he did. They told him that they would, since he didn't use it or make any claims on it, in other words, if he would fix his car, they would take whatever the cost of that fix was against what he paid. And so he asked them how much it would be to fix his car, and they said, we would actually have to give us more money than what you gave us for the policy. Then he said, well, that's not a very good policy. So he said, you're right. I think I'm going to look for, I need to look for a car and figure that out. And I'm like, okay.
Do we think we need some adult classes here? I hear these commercials on these auto repair policies. And, well, if you what's the one that's all over the place now?
Endurance.
Auto Shield, maybe?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah, whatever. Call these guys and then you'll learn. Does anybody actually think that somebody is selling a policy to where they're going to pay more repair on average than you pay them? How does...
But they did. Honest to God, this went on. And so within like 2 or 3 days, we had that whole car problem solved. And this is someone who is living in Indiana and wants to come back to Illinois. And he said, I really can't find anything that I really fell in love with. He said, I think I'm just going to rent. And I'm like, that's okay. I mean, that's okay. Right? I mean, he's going to get back here and then figure it out. But he doesn't want to feel rushed into buying something when he can't find something he really likes in the price range he's looking for.
Well, you did have a bunch of people who were having credit card and debt issues and were looking to, were even on a 3% mortgage, was looking good to you can do the math. And
those have gone through. I mean, those have gone through, but it's still compared to, I mean, the thousands of, it's a onesie, twosie, it's one-off. That's how that is. There is no steady stream of anything right now. And I would have thought that rates, honestly, I would have thought rates would have, everybody was in this, you know, we're waiting for Trump to lower the rate thing. They're finally starting to believe me that it's not going to happen.
No.
At least not this year. But, all right, we're at least in a time frame now that's more realistic for this year or not. And people are saying, well, I'll just have to wait till next year then. So I just don't believe rates can ever go down into the 3 or 4s. Do you guys think
so?
I was just reading something the other day about zombie properties and how they're exploding in numbers. So, you know, properties that have been abandoned because they, you know, the financing has fallen apart, or they just, somebody lost their job, they just walk away from it, and the lender isn't putting any money into it or aggressively marketing it. It's kind of what's happened in the commercial market on a greater scale. But I'm wondering if you see any impact in the way that people are, in the market now, competing for mortgage money. Are there a lot of homes that nobody has any interest in? I mean, I know this, like distress operations, that are picking up property, pay any cash, they'll fix it up and sell it. And I guess it's a flourishing industry, but I wonder if this is making it harder for people to have inventory when there's so many homes that are not, saleable, and there's nobody around to put money into them to make them saleable. And this is also hurting prices because the people at the high end can kind of write their own deals, but the people at the low end are competing for a smaller and smaller body of homes that are livable.
I do believe that this problem doesn't have a name yet, and it's not easily recognizable on the news, but it's growing.
I mean, you're talking about,
it's growing.
By the way, Jimmy, you can opine on this if you want. You're talking about a general degradation of home value, the housing stock in a neighborhood, making it more difficult for somebody to actually fix one up because he's the only one with a fixed up one. Is that what you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about homes that are just abandoned and they tried to sell it.
Well, the effect on the people around them, essentially, right, Jen?
Yeah. I mean, it may help comparables by bringing prices down because some of these properties are real stink bombs when you drive past them. And it hurts everybody around them. But it also, these properties are not really part of the real estate market anymore. They're just sort of sitting there. They're not earning tax revenue for the counties. And nobody really has any kind of plan to bring them back down and make them competitive.
Go ahead, Jimmy. This was Jimmy's business.
You know, with a zombie property, it depends. If the lender wants it to be turned over to the state or this or that, they won't pay any taxes. But otherwise, if they think they can do something, they are obligated to pay the taxes now. They own the property, especially if it was foreclosed. But I have seen it where they have tax liens, and at that point, you're right, they abandoned it. They don't care at that point.
How can you tell if that number is growing or coming down is what I guess is Jan's question.
That's a good question. You'd have to look at the tax receipts basically, I have a friend who does this. He looks at the properties that go up for auction on taxes. That the county have six people, the county will produce a list of everyone who's delinquent on property taxes and put them up. This is the lender's worst fear because that is that will supersede their lien. In my previous job, that happened a couple of times that someone bought the property for, a $300,000 property for $42,000 because $42,000 hadn't been paid. Somewhere along the line, one of the servicers did not pay property taxes. And all of a sudden, it went to auction and someone bought it. Now, you can't foreclose right away. There is a redemption period, and that changes by state and county by county. But it does happen that someone forgets, and then all of a sudden, wham, you lost the property.
Does that answer your question, John?
Yeah, and it seems, this was in USA Today or some national newspaper saying how all these states, you know, and it gave like profiles of some of them where the number of these properties has exploded. And I don't know if it's exploding around the Chicago area or not, but it seems to be, and you know, it certainly has happened in the commercial market where you've got these dinosaur buildings that they don't know how to, you know, retrofit or convert to residential and make it affordable. So you got these properties that are pretty much unmarketable. So,
well, Nance, if lady, we got a dash here, but I'll go a minute over with this group. Lady was talking on one of those news shows this weekend, and Chicago has 10,000, which I think she said at least 10,000 properties in the city that essentially they own. Or I don't know exactly who owns those properties, but if it gets punted to the city, does the city have to pay the county portion of the tax, or do they stiff the county? How does that all work?
I think they've got arrangements for exemptions if the city has taken it, like by demolition lien foreclosure, they knocked the house down, and now they foreclose on their lien for the demolition costs, and you know the city, I'm sure, has some sort of a handshake deal with the county, but you know they'll get a break on the taxes in order to get the thing back on the tax rolls and have somebody build on it.
Well, it gets back to what Nance was asking. I believe Nance was saying, what if somebody can get a couple of those properties and wants to build a couple of houses? How do you do it if the rest of the block looks like crap?
Yeah.
Well, that's the decision that they have, whoever buys it has to make. Are they regentrifying? What are they doing? You know, what's wrong with just backing them down and building something that's affordable for the people in the area?
Well, that's the thing, yeah. But it's,
I mean, VA, you get 100%. FHA, you only need 3% down. I just don't know if people can build houses anymore from scratch for, you know, 150 or 200,000. We used to know how to do that. What happened to that?
I go to the Home Depot, find out what the prices are. Yeah, I mean, it's crazy.
Well, okay, but wouldn't that help?
Well, you would think, but that was what we talked about this maybe 3 weeks ago. You guys were, you know, who was it? One of the guys in the Senate was talking about how we need a million new houses in this country and to get the prices down. And I'm thinking, the replacement value of every house there is higher than the house, isn't it?
Right.
And Nancy,
that is a huge problem.
Well, you were just, you know, I did some work at open house today. I'll say $1.5 million house. I don't know what you guys are asking for it or not, but I'm gonna go out on a limb. I'll put my little pinky up in the air drinking wine. You couldn't put the place up today for $1.5 million.
No.
You think you could, Nancy?
Oh, you mean rebuild it?
Yeah.
That, I don't know. Boy, you're right. I mean, I agree. I agree. My house is worth more on insurance paper than it is for what I could sell it for.
Yes.
But, I mean, if you actually had to rebuild it.
That's what I mean. Yeah. If the rebuilding cost is actually probably a good $100,000 to $150,000 more than what I could sell my house for. Now, that is insanity. We've got a problem with that.
There's people who have put $100,000 in their kitchen. They didn't pay $100,000 for the house.
Oh, dear Lord. I mean, I know you're right. I've seen it.
Of course, when you bought it, it didn't have TVs and all that stuff in the kitchen and the little garage doors to cover up your junk behind the counter and stuff. I like those.
I did, too. I saw one this weekend. It was really cool.
You ever see one of those, John? Anyway, guys, good stuff. S&P futures down 22, NASDAQ futures down 112. Nance, a new low. You actually aim for stuff on the pavement to wreck your tires so you don't have to see me, I hear.
Oh, dear Lord. That's what I thought you would say.
Yeah, well.
That's exactly what I thought you would say when this was going on, that if he heard this, he'll just say, see what she ditched you.
Anyway, good luck with all that.
I gotta leave for there now to see how much damage is done to this car.
Oh God! Just be careful. They turn all the sensors back on. Anyway,
I couldn't believe the whole thing. I couldn't believe with today's technology, no one could tell me where I was at when SOS didn't work, Blue Link didn't work. They were saying they could not get a pin on where I was at. So all these shows where they say drop me a pin, do this, do that, none of that works, guys.
You sound like the guy in Nebraska talking about the tornado. I see a funnel cloud, and the lady goes, where are you? I'm in my truck.
Hey, I do have one cute thing. A couple of men did stop to try and say, could we help you in any way? And they said, do you have a real tire or a donut? And I said, I really don't know. I don't think it's going to make much difference because I have two flats. Not really going to help anything. And the guy said, well, I could help you if you had a real tire, but I can't change a donut. And I thought, okay, I don't know a thing about how to change a tire, but I do think that if you knew how to change the tire, you could put the donut on and it would work.
It still wouldn't give you two.
No, it wouldn't give me two, but there's no difference. I just want to say, is there a difference between changing a tire to a real tire or a donut? It works the same, right?
Works the same.
Mechanics work the same. See, and where were you two? You abandoned me.
I would say that what you need, I'll get you a nice truck with the big heavy tires. You'd be good to go.
I take anything than do what happened on Saturday.
Anyway, good luck.
So,
be back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Bye.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now.
No, I didn't. Honest. I ran out of gas. I had a flat tire. I didn't have enough money for cab fare. My tux didn't come back from the cleaners. An old friend came in from out of town. Someone stole my car. There was an earthquake. A terrible flood. Locust. It wasn't my fault. I swear to God.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to ptisecurities.com. PTI ProDirect. Trade for as low as a penny per share and a dollar per option contract. Learn more at ptiprodirect.com. Nadex, offering an intuitive way to trade the financial markets. Visit nadex.com. HomeSource Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. DAX Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.
How would you like to save money on nearly all your prescription drugs? We've set up a special toll-free number for the RX Outreach Program. They're a nonprofit company whose mission it is to make prescription drugs more affordable to the masses. They don't take insurance, and in many cases, your prescriptions are even cheaper than your co-pays. They carry thousands of different prescription drugs, so whatever you're taking, there's a good chance they have it. No coupons are required, and this is not a discount card. It is pure savings on your prescription drugs. They specialize in generic meds for any chronic health needs you have. Call with your prescription and find out for free how little you can pay for your prescription drugs. Remember, we don't take insurance, so call right now.
800-586-9885. 800-586-9885. 800-586-9885. That's 800-586-9885.